Hei alle sammen, og velkommen til Go Open, velkommen til Det Norske Teater, og velkommen til to dager med over 500 mennesker, 50 foredrag, masse kunnskap og solide nettverksbygging. Jeg er stolt av å ønske dere velkommen til Go Open, som er den største kunnskaps- og nettverksarenaen for deling, samarbeid, lønnsomhet, gjenbruk og innovasjon. And a special warm thank and warm welcome to all our international guests, and apologize for giving my speech in Norwegian, but I promise to translate for you later. Go Open er en framtidskonferanse. Det er en konferanse om frihet til å velge, frihet til å bruke og frihet til å dele. For det er det fri programvare handler om. Go Open skal gi kunnskap om fri programvare. Kunnskap som kan gi dere trygghet til å velge, trygghet til å samarbeide, og ikke minst friheten til å dele. Og da skal Go Open være en døråpner til framtiden. Dere skal av meg få gull, som dere skal forvalte alene siden. For framtiden, den krever åpenhet, og den krever samarbeid, og den krever deling. Offentlig sektor står overfor utrolig store utfordringer framover. Det er færre unge som skal ta vare på flere eldre med knappere ressurser. Og mange av disse utfordringene kan og bør løses med bruk av nettopp fri programvare. Og det er det mange som allerede har gjort. De velger fri programvare fordi det er faglig sett det beste, fordi det er det mest stabile, og ikke minst fordi det er lønnsomt. I dag er det 429 kommuner, 341 offentlige etater, og ikke minst 19 fylkeskommuner. Og under her er det en hel haug med offentlige organisasjoner. Hver især av disse tar sine selvstendige IT-beslutninger, og det betyr i praksis at det investeres i 429 regnskapsprogram som faktisk skal utføre akkurat den samme oppgaven. Det er lite lønnsom bruk av offentlige midler, og ikke minst av skattepengene våre. Og det har Friprogsenteret gjort noe med, og skal fortsette å gjøre noe med også framover. Derfor er jeg også veldig stolt av å kunne lansere Delingsbasaren for dere i dag. Det er en plattform for deling av programvare, innhold og prosjekter. Her finner dere innhold som kan brukes direkte, sånn som det ligger i dag, og det kan videreutvikles, og ikke minst så kan det tilpasses lokale behov. Og i tillegg til disse norske løsningene, så samarbeider vi tett i de nordiske landene, sånn at man kan finne innhold både fra svensk offentlig sektor og dansk offentlig sektor. Det er fordi offentlig sektor i Norden ligner på hverandre, og vi har valgt å åpne dørene til våre naboland og samarbeider tett med de andre nordiske kompetansesentrene. Dette for å skape delingskultur og lønnsom drift i offentlig sektor. Vi vet at 3 av 5 har lyst til å bruke fri programvare i framtiden, altså av lederne. Fordi det gir de fleksibilitet, det gir de bedre tjenester, og det er lønnsomt. Men så er det noen barrierer, og de mangler nettopp kompetansen på hvem leverandørene er og hva de kan få. Det skal vi gjøre noe med, og som uavhengig kompetansesenter for fri programvare, så skal nettopp Friprogsenteret bidra til økt kunnskap og trygghet for valg av lønnsomme framtidsløsninger. Vi skal være oversetterne. Vi skal folkeliggjøre hva fri programvare er for de som ikke er teknologer. Vi skal være brobyggerne mellom næringsliv og offentlig sektor, mellom kunder og leverandører, og mellom kommunegrenser og offentlige etater. Vi skal være døråpnerne til framtiden. Ambisiøst og pompøst nok. Gartner har anslått at i 2012 så vil 80% av all programvareutvikling være basert på fri programvare. Og Unumerit, som dere får høre senere på denne konferansen, har anslått at 32% av alle IT-tjenester og ca. 4% av Europas BNP vil være basert på fri programvare innen 2010. Så dette er ingen bløff. Dette er ikke en døgnflue. Fri programvare er en av de sterkeste utviklingstrendene, og det ser vi også i Norge. En nylig avsluttet studie ved NTNU viser at nærmere 50% av norske programvarebedrifter benytter seg av fri programvarekomponenter i sin utvikling i dag, og at det er et økende prosenttall. Og det er produkter som da blir levert til kunder i alle mulige bransjer. Flere og flere IT-selskaper benytter seg av fri programvare og gjør veldig god business. Både norske og globale selskaper velger åpenhet som sin innovasjonsstrategi. Og stadig oftere ser vi menn i dress, ikke så mange damer riktig nok, men menn i dress som også kommer fra fri programvareselskaper. Vi ser at selskaper benytter seg av innhold og ideer som er generert utenfor eget selskap. Utviklingsavdelingen har blitt global og ikke lokal, og dette sparer selskapene for produksjonskostnader og sprer risikoen. Det er modig å velge åpenhet, men det viser seg likevel at det lønner seg. I Kanada var det en gullgruve som gikk utrolig dårlig. De klarte rett og slett ikke å finne gull, og da går det jo dårlig med gullgruver. De bestemte seg for å legge alle sine kartdata åpne tilgjengelige og utlyse en stor konkurranse for de som klarte å hjelpe dem med å identifisere hvor gullet var. Og det var en modig avgjørelse, fordi de la bedriftssensitiv informasjon åpent ut og tilgjengelig for alle. Så satte folk i hele verden og hjalp dem med å identifisere gullet, og i dag er det en av gullgruvene som går best i verden. Samtidig så er det viktig for meg å understreke at fri programvare, det handler ikke om bare ting som er gratis. Men vår jobb er å skape en konkurranse i markedet, et marked som det strengt tatt er plass til flere i. Og konkurranse vil skjerpe hver enkelt og bidra til bedre og mer spennende produkter. Og ikke minst også utviklingsmodeller. Og fri programvare vil også være veldig, veldig bra for norsk næringsliv og norsk næringsutvikling. Også på Go Open kan dere være med i en åpen innovasjonsprosess. Telenor og iLabs arrangerer en egen konkurranse via Go Open-bloggen. Og selvfølgelig er det premier involvert, og mer informasjon om det kan dere få ute på Telenor sin stand. Så har det seg sånn at same size fits all, det er aldri gode brukeropplevelser av IT-løsninger som bygger på det. Ei heller konferanse-t-skjorter. Derfor så er jeg veldig stolt av å kunne gi alle jenter og kvinner, eller damer, som er her i dag, for en gang skyld en lyserosa bling-bling-t-skjorte i jentefasong. Og det er også fordi jeg ønsker meg flere jenter i IT-næringen. Det er snart søknadsfrist til høyere utdanning, så gå hjem og fortell dem at IT-næringen, det handler om å jobbe med viktige framtidsutfordringer. Og derfor lanserer vi også og drar det danske konseptet Girl Project over til Norge. T-skjorter for begge kjønn og mer informasjon om Girl Project-prosjektet. Det får dere også utenfor på selvsagt den lyserosa standen. Jeg er også veldig stolt over å fortelle dere at vi i samarbeid med Papirbredden Innovasjon i Drammen har fått ansvar for å drive fram et europeisk senter for kvinner og teknologi. Og det er det hard konkurranse om å få. Go Open et stort dugnadsprosjekt, og samarbeidspartnerne veldig, veldig mange. Dette ikke et lass friprogsenteret har dratt alene. Så derfor har jeg lyst til å rette en stor takk til alle sponsorer, hovedsponsorer og alle andre. Takk til alle samarbeidende organisasjoner, til Advisory Board og enkeltpersoner som har muliggjort disse to ambisiøse dagene. Takk til alle som har vært med å organisere og fylle programmet med innhold. Og allerede nå, før vi har startet ordentlig, så synes jeg de fortjener en stor applaus. Tolvskillingsoperaen får dere se senere i kveld. Og for de som ikke har fått billetter til den enda, så det antageligvis mulig å få noen restbilletter som ligger nede. Og jeg vil anbefale det på det sterkeste. Jeg så det på premieren, det har fått seksere og femmere og bare masse skryt, og en fantastisk forestilling. I tillegg så det noe som skjer klokken 16.50 i dag etter det ordinære programmet. Da vil det foregå en debatt her inne som heter «Hvor åpne Microsoft?» og som en debatt om den pågående standardiseringsprosessen og alt bråket som har vært rundt den. Det tror jeg kommer til å bli en veldig spennende debatt. Den arrangeres i sin helhet av Computer World, og den blir også streamet og lagt ut på nett. Og etter det selvfølgelig så det mat og gratis drikke både med og uten alkohol ute i foajeen. Hvis det skulle friste for noen, før tolvskillingsoperaen. Dette Nordens største konferanse om åpenhet og om innovasjon, om fri programvare og lønnsomme framtidsløsninger. Jeg håper dere får kunnskap og kompetanse til å ta i bruk fri programvare, nettverk som vil skape innovasjon og tryggheten til å velge nytt. Og når det kommer til valg av programvare, så det folkens faktisk lov til å være utro. Der det lov til å skifte partner annenhver dag, om man skulle ønske det. Men kun når det gjelder valg av programvare. Så med dette har jeg lyst til å si velkommen til Go Open, en konferanse om å dele framtiden. Så vil jeg også ønske velkommen til konferansens konferansier. Han heter Øystein Johannessen. Han avdelingsdirektør i Kunnskapsdepartementet og også styremedlem hos Statens Dataforum, som en av våre tette samarbeidspartnere. Det veldig mye å si om Øystein Johannessen og hans kvalifikasjoner, men jeg kan nevne noe. Han har gjort en heroisk innsats for å sette IKT i utdanningen på kartet i OECD-sammenheng, og han en aktiv kraft i studien som heter New Millennium Learners. Ønsk velkommen til Øystein.
Ja, hører dere meg?
Ja.
Ja, mitt navn altså Øystein Johannessen, men for å bidra til the best go open ever, har jeg for anledningen tatt kunstnernavnet Ola fra Sandefjord. Gitt min rolle som bilingual moderator i plenum. Jeg sier moderator, det liksom føles litt mer moderne. Konferansier, det litt sånn 50-talls, Heidi. Det altså jeg som skal jage talerne opp og ned fra scenen, og det jeg som skal gi dere en del praktisk informasjon, og da skal jeg starte med de to første formaningen i dag. Den første mobiltelefoner, shh, og så videre. Det andre ikke ta kaffekopper med inn hit, da en del folk som blir litt leise. To our international keynotes, I would like to say the following. In spite of my position in government, you are not in the spirit of peace, love and understanding. Obliged to call me your honor. In return, you are kindly expected to stick to the time frame you have been allotted, more or less. Should you, however, choose not to do so, let me remind you, still in the true spirit of peace, love, and understanding, I do know where all of you live. This is called an offer you cannot refuse. Now, let's turn to our first keynote. He's a representative of a posh little company out west called Google. And some of you may even have heard about it. Chris de Bono is the open source program manager at Google, a job that includes running the summer code program and managing projects on Google Code. Prior to joining Google, Chris was an editor at Slashdot and co-founded Damage Studios. Now, Damage Studios, that sounds like a lot of chaos to me, and according to Chris, it also ended in chaos. So he's also probably a chaos pilot. He also co-edited Open Source's Voices from the Open Source Revolution and Open Source 2.0. So Chris, stage is yours. Give them hell.
Thank you, my liege. I appreciate that. It's not often I'm threatened on the way up to the podium. It usually happens afterwards. As you mentioned, my name's Chris de Bono. I have a slide that tells you all about me. It mostly yammers on about things I've done in the past. Yeah, that's pretty much it. As you can see, I'm kind of a slacker. I have sort of a funny job at the company. People have heard of what we've done externally with regards to the Summer of Code and the code hosting and the rest, or some people have. Okay, one of you has. But you don't think about sort of the boring part of the job, which is, of course, what I find the most stimulating, which is bringing code into the company and letting code leave the company. And I might talk about that. I might not. I'm going to wing it. Let's see now. Code release, summer code, protocol, who cares? Okay, good. So this is my agenda. I'm not going to say much about that. So this is Google. That's your query right there. We used to have people sit at this keyboard and just type responses, you know. So you type in Canon camera and they'd say, they're good, you know. HTTP Canon. So realistically though, when I call these the baby pictures for the company, because they're early pictures of the company. But what you're looking at here is the last heterogeneous network that we had. You see, the founders needed computers to run their experiments on. So they walked through the computer science building at Stanford, and they said, well, that computer doesn't look like anyone's using it. And so they collected a bunch of computers this way, just going from office to office looking for mostly plugged-in computers. And then if people got upset, they gave them back. So this is how we originally formed the company. You'll notice a couple of things here, some Sun machines over here. I think this is IBM. Some Dell machines, some Legos. We joke about this, but these actually, they're not as sturdy as you'd think for building computers out of. So it would fall apart, not through any, well, okay, so I think it's worth pointing out, I don't know if I have a zoom in on this, no, I don't. But these are actually not really Legos, they're sort of a knockoff that they got at one of the big warehouse stores, so it fell apart even faster, so. So we were always very, very cheap. But the lesson of this is that even back then, we always said to ourselves, well, okay, we can go out and spend $100,000 on a beautiful server with redundant this and redundant that and RAID and hard drives and whatever. Or we could spend that same $100,000 and get a rack of junk. So this was important. This is the same thing, by the way, thank you, that all of you were buying. These are desktop hard drives, desktop network cards, desktop motherboards, desktop switches. I mean, this is a disaster through any desire for advanced enterprise, this and that. But there was a reason for it. We decided that early on to spend extra money on incredibly reliable hardware wouldn't get us as much from planning for that unreliability. So what we did instead is we said, okay, well, how can we cram as much power, as much CPU power, and as much storage into a small space as we can. And back then, that meant corkboard and absurdities. How many of you are IT people who look at data centers every day? Yeah. So what's wrong with this?
I like it.
You love it? You're crazy. You're fired. Well, there's all kinds of problems. Let me point out some of the problems we had. So see these wires along here? Yeah. So these are network cards here. When you'd pull them out to fix them, the network cards would catch on the wires and they'd snap off. And by snap, I don't mean like delicately pulled out. I mean, they'd break right along here. And also, you'll notice the hard drives here. They're balanced on top of a layer of plexiglass on top of the memory. So airflow wasn't great. And whenever one would fail, four would fail because you'd have to disconnect them and pull them out and all the rest. And there were some very real thermal issues. And you can see here how they sort of bow, you know? And bowing is bad. Just so you know. And the way the thermals worked, all the heat would go that way, you know? And so up top, they got really hot. We had a couple of incidences where we were running some fairly intense jobs on one of our clusters. And the motherboard, controller board and the hard drives actually melted and desoldered themselves. And that's bad. But the thing is, you never noticed that if you were using Google at the time, because your query would just go to the working computer. It wouldn't go to the broken one. We had written all this great software for balancing out these loads. And so it was very, very rare to get back a query that was incomplete and broken. So we continued this. What you'll notice here is the advanced cooling mechanism. What's funny about this is this fan has been at every company I've ever worked at. It's probably in your previous employer's data center. But if you know much about computers, these are rackables and these are the HP Pro curves. Back then, HP would sell these with like two populated blades and then a whole bunch of empty blades for you to fill them in, but you could buy them really cheap. So we just buy a bunch of them, rip the blades out of one, put them in the other, and it was awesome. And we're getting a little better, right? This is circa 2000. And then we got into sort of more advanced systems where we would walk into a data center and we would install this amount of computers in about 3 hours. We just back up the truck, drop them off, plug them in, configure the router, walk away. And we were getting really good at this, and this was really important for us. And what's funny about this is basically, and since this original Stanford installation, it's been Linux, 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 right? So what you're looking at is Linux running as the operating system, and on top of that is Google, right? And I'll talk a little bit more about that. And then we went to this sort of design. This is hard to explain because I don't think we ever actually deployed this particular thing, but it's close enough so that you would get an idea. This is inside one of those little Mint tins, little Altoid tins, and it runs on a 9-volt battery. No, I'm kidding. So lots of computers, and it's exposed a little bit more here. And what you're looking at is, again, you'll notice something interesting. There's no cases in the front and back of this, right? We didn't want anything to impede airflow. And again, it's again thanks to the incredible economies of scale that the entire consumer business brings to the computer business that we were able to take advantage of this stuff, right? So we're getting the same hard drives that you got in your desktop machines, the same memory even, you know, the same CPUs. We weren't using server classes or that. We were using the same junk that you were. And there was a reason for that, right? Because paying extra for the extreme high end never made sense financially to us. You could buy, so for instance, back in the beginning, if you were buying SCSI drives, you could buy the equivalent ATA drives with like 4 or 5 times the capacity for the same money. And that capacity is dear to us, right? Because we're doing these incredible things with the data where we're churning through it and giving out more output and churning through that, and we an absurd amount of CPU time. I can't actually tell you, but it's like we have like 12 computers now. And it's crazy. Well, we have more than 12. But it's almost pathological how much CPU time we use. And so, you know, we have to be able to get the most out of our money. And the way we do that is not by spending a lot of money on off-the-shelf software even. You know, we download open source software, we use it whenever we can, we write our own stuff on top of it, and it's all optimized for speed. So, anyway, but what am I actually here to talk about? So I'm here to talk about open source at Google, right? One of the things I like to do is talk about just how we use it and why we think it's important. And I guess that's why you have me here. Excuse me, I'm just getting some water. I mean, that's why people have me come talk, so you're going to be subjected to it. But I want to start off by talking about why people do open source at all. Back when I was working at VA, we ran a site called SourceForge. And we were approached by these folks over at MIT Sloan School of Management. They said, we're really curious as to why people do this open source stuff. And we're like, oh God, another business school person who wants to do a study. But we're like, okay, whatever. They were nice. And they had the cachet. So we're like, okay. So we actually asked 10,000 open source software developers why they actually do what they do. And I was really happy to do this on the other side because, you know, so many people had these ideas as to why people did open source software. They said it was a gift economy. It was all altruism. It was a cargo cult. I mean, I remember one of my friends used to go around saying, it's a cargo cult. Like in The Gods Must Be Crazy. It's like a Coke bottle dropped from an airplane. I'm like, what? You're insane, you know? I thought it was like the dumbest thing I've ever heard, and I was right. So we found out that, you know, this is actually why most people are doing open source software, or their majority reason they're doing it. We ask people just to check off which ones matter to them. And it's like, they're curious. They want to get smarter. They want to get better at running their machines, at doing their computer science, at writing their programs, right? Like many, they don't want to wake up at 3 in the morning because a server is down, because something is going on. How many of you have children? Okay, you're already waking up at 3 in the morning. The rest of you. I have a 17-month-old, and he's reminded me. I had a 7-year-old. She's sleeping through the night, though. And then we had this other baby. Anyway, but the rest of you having children is like running Exchange. they always want something from you, okay? And it's cool when it's your children, okay? Because you're like your dad. You know, you want to take care of the little baby, right? But if it's a computer thing, you're like, I was sleeping, man. And so, you know, people just wanted to make their life a little better. That's pretty cool, you know? And they wanted to get smarter. And then there's this open source idealism. We didn't quantify that, really, what that meant. But that was about all of us working together on computer science, making software better, making computer science better. And I think that's an incredibly cheery thing, even if only a third of us wanted that. And then there's these other things. This sort of mixes with that, and that mixes with that. But this is the cool one here. So only one out of 10 people is doing it because they're pissed off. Right? Pissed off is American for, what's a good Norwegian word for pissed off? No. What's that? I'll go to the young people. Fobana? No. So whatever he said. So basically, you know, only one in 10 people are actually upset about it. Enough that that's what's driving them. And I think that's like the worst reason to do something. So this is an important slide. More important than I know. So, and the reason I put that before this slide is people are always asking me, it's like, wow, aren't you taking that stuff? Aren't you, you know, you guys are just, you know, stealing this software. And I'm like, how can you steal something that's given to you for free, you know, specifically for your use? I mean, people in the open source world know what they're doing when they release code. When Zach, here, hi Zach, releases code, he knows you might use it. That's why he's releasing it. And that's why, what's the last piece of software you released, Zach?
A WordPress plugin.
And what license was it under?
BSD.
So if I took that thing that you wrote for WordPress and I incorporated it in some commercial product, how do you feel about that? He stuck it under VSD license, so he's okay with it, right? So Zach's an adult. We're all adults, even the younger folks among us. How old are you? 18. So he's an adult. I think 16's an adult. Whatever. The point is, people understand what they're doing. I didn't mean to. Please don't. Listen, the reason I got into computer science is nobody took me seriously when I was 12 years old, okay? computers, if they compile, it's your fault. If they fail, it's your fault. Whatever. It's not because you're a kid, right? Where's I going with that? But the point is, open source software developers know what they're doing when they give away their software. So if you want to use their software, it is there for you to use. And that sounds like a tautology because it is. But there's a lot of people out there who are saying, well, you know, this open source software stuff, it's scary and weird and strange. It's not. It's just software. And people like Zach, people like myself, we're just giving it away because we want you to use it. That's why we release them under these licenses. But Google, how does Google use open source? Well, whenever you use Google, you're actually using Linux. Linux sits at the bottom of every server at Google. It even sits in some of our equipment, our routers. I mean, you name it. We use Linux everywhere. We use it like crazy. It forms the basis for the Android operating system that we're releasing for cell phones. It's very, very important to us. So we use Linux. We actually don't use a lot of Apache the way you think of Apache. So many of you, raise your hands if you're using the Apache web server. So we actually don't use that. Where we see it and Tomcat is when we buy companies, they're usually running it. But we've written our own server infrastructure because it's more suited to our rather unreliable environment that I mentioned earlier. We use a ton of crypto tools and SSH and system management tools. They're very, very important to us. And I like to call out compilers specifically. How many of you own an iPhone? Those are not allowed, right? An iPod. How many of you own iPods? Wow, that's great. How many of you own cell phones? How many of you drive cars? How many of you live? So the point I'm trying to make here is that almost every embedded device uses GCC. The creators of those devices use GCC to create the firmware that runs in everything. And by everything, I mean dishwashers. I mean dryers. I mean you name it, your iPod, your iPhone. These are really important things to understand. So basically, I see open source everywhere, right? Like that kid who saw dumb people everywhere. I see open source everywhere. That laptop, the computer goods that control these lights that those guys in that little box are running. I mean, everything. Little sliders, you know. And we use them at Google, and we spend a lot of time thinking about how we can make them better. So we try to release new linkers, new technology there. And then we use it on our desktop. You know, most Google engineers are running Linux, and that's a great thing. But the thing is, again, when you're using Google, you're using this layer of Linux, and on top of that is a bunch of Google software that incorporates libraries like Zax, built using open source tools. So it's very important to us. When we release software, we use open source because we're trying to be that adult, right? When you use software that people give you because they want you to use their platform or their tools, often they're licensed under fairly specious terms that basically require your firstborn or first twoborn is their term for that. But basically, when we give away software at Google, we try to make sure that it's under a proper third-party controlled open source license. So for instance, when we release Google Gears, which allows you to do offline web stuff, which is a very cool tool, runs inside your browser. We released it under, I believe, the BSD license, the Apache license, I don't remember which. But the whole point of that was to say to people, listen, we know that if you're going to be developing to this, you'll want to develop something, develop against something that isn't going to hold you hostage. You know, there's no point in us releasing this piece of what we consider fundamental web technology and not giving it away, right? So this is why we try to default to the Apache license, because in the event that Google says, we're not going to work on Gears anymore, Zach can. He can just take the code we released before and improve it. Any of you can. And then you can release it as your own. And this is a really important thing. If you talk to a lot of folks with their business degrees, they'll always talk about things like lock-in, and about, you know, keeping your customer base kind of controlled, right? And we're trying not to do that, because we feel that Google flourishes in a fair and competitive environment. And that particular environment is the internet, right? So if the internet was all controlled, we wouldn't be using it. I remember when I was, 20 years old, 21 years old, 22, I was working for this law firm, and they specialized in intellectual property law. I remember getting on the elevator with this lawyer, and he says, you know what, Chris? I can't believe that the world is standardizing on TCP/IP. And if you remember back then, people were talking about TCP/IP and SNA and all these other networking protocols. And he said, if they'd only had proper patent coverage on TCP/IP, I could have gotten us a penny per packet. And I just looked at him. I said, are you kidding me? He's like, well, no, what do you mean? I said, that's why they didn't pick SNA. That's why they didn't pick these other formats, because there was somebody who wanted a penny per packet. He's like, oh, we could have come up with something fair. And I was like, no, you don't understand. There was no incentive for them to adopt TCP/IP if it meant having to pay a penny. Suppose Zach was the guy who had the penny per packet. That would have been good for you. you know, people don't adopt those things because they don't want to give up control. And that's a lot of why Google adopts open source anyway. And we want to basically say, listen, you know, we know that's how the world is. If people have too much control, that's no good, right? So suppose Google had to ask permission, functionally ask permission, before we deploy software. And that's what you do when you pay licenses, right? So suppose, well, I have to say, we have certain competitors, whose name I won't mention, who have said they don't like us much, right? So imagine if they say we don't like them very much, and at the same time, we're asking them for licenses for software, or we're asking for a change to that operating system. So a really good example of this, French Telecom was shipping a cell phone, and it was based on Windows Mobile, and this is actually not an anti-Microsoft talk in the slightest, I promise. They were shipping on Windows Mobile, and it was the first time they were going to be shipping a phone that had push-to-talk, you know, doo-doo. Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay, that guy does, so whatever. And they were, how am I doing on time? I'm not tracking. Anyway, someone's going to raise their hand and say, I've got 5 minutes when it comes time anyway. So France Telecom, they needed to ship this phone. And this phone was pretty neat. It allowed this push-to-talk thing. They had spent billions on updating their infrastructure so that they could accommodate push-for-talk and these other features that they wanted this phone to showcase. And shipping a phone takes years because you have to provision all this stuff and junk and all the rest. And so they went to go ship this phone, and they noticed that every fifth call didn't work. It's died. They're like, wow, that sucks, right? So they went to their rep, and they said, hey, we're having this problem. Every fifth call, it's dropping it, and we think it's this DLL that we found. And their rep said, which version are you using? They told them. They said, oh, yeah, we know about that. We've got a patch for that. Great, can we have the patch? And they're like, oh, no, it's in the next version of the operating system. They're like, great, can we have that? And they said, sure, you can have that. Can we have that now? And they said, no, you can't. You can have it in 18 months. And they're like, we're shipping in 3 months. And they're like, I'm sorry. It's just not worth it to us to fork the operating system for you. How many of you are software engineers? So you know, if you have to make a special version of your software for one customer, that one customer has to be very, very valuable to you. And at the time, France Telecom was 3% of Windows Mobile shipments. So they could afford to alienate them. And they said to them, I'm sorry, we'd like to help you, but we can't. We can't afford to fork the operating system just for you. We can't afford the extra support costs. We can't afford it. We're sorry. And I'm sure they were. But here's the thing. If they'd been using Linux, if they'd been using BSD, if they'd been using an open source software package, they could have just fixed the problem themselves. And they could, assuming they didn't have the technical acumen to do that, could have just hired somebody. Because the software was theirs to use. It was theirs to own. Right? Again, under the open source licenses, which have very specific things you must do if you use them. But they're not onerous. And the code is there for you to use. This isn't to say that proprietary organizations aren't happy to write you a source code license. They are. But the great thing about open source is the license is already there. The code is already there. All you have to do is figure out if you're comfortable with that license. And then you're good to go. So you see this problem over and over again in computer science and the computer industry, where basically we talk about control a lot. We talk about lock-in a lot. But what we're really talking about is flexibility. Right? And this is so important to Google. I can't tell you how many times we've had a problem with the Linux kernel, with GCC, with any of the libraries. And we say to ourselves, wow, we can just fix this and push out the fix. And that's exactly what we do. And it's my job then to also take those fixes and to release them to people like you, the public. Right? And that's really, really nice that we can do that. And finally, this last thing, it sounds awful, right? No one is incentivized to hurt us. Because it implies a lot, right? It implies that people don't like Google. But there are people who don't like Google. There are people who don't like what we do. There are people who have been very, very public that they don't like what we do and want to, well, anyways. And that's a shame and too bad, because I don't think we're all that bad. But the point is, when you have very powerful enemies, they're willing to use any angle they can to stop you. But when you use open source software, there's no one to stop, right? Open source can't be taken back. Linus Torvalds can't decide that, you know, all these old versions of Linux that Google's been using, I can't use them anymore because he's already released them. all the writers of GCC, all the languages, they can't take it back, right? There's no one who's actually being paid to hurt us in open source software, because no one can be. Because in the end, we can control our own destiny. And so can you, and that's really important. And finally, you know, I want to stress mightily how important it is, this whole idea that we're standing on the shoulders of giants. The software that we all depend on all the time, very little of it is actually unique, right? And at Google, we really don't want to be rewriting the same piece of software over and over and over again. So we try to use the open source one whenever possible, and we try to release whenever we can, so that you too can enjoy our software the same way that we've enjoyed yours. So, anyway, how do we take part? Well, this is the self-aggrandizing portion of this talk. I don't know how long I've been talking about, what, 25 minutes? Someone's keeping track. I can't tell. So someone will mention. 5 minutes? Yeah? Okay, I'll burn through this. So we've released about, this is way out of date. We release about 1 million lines of code a year now. There are some examples there. Enjoy them. The point of this is to say, listen, releasing source code sounds important and impressive and daunting, but if you just make it part of your company and just make it part of your process, it's actually really good for you. So, yeah, we're releasing these tools. But you know what's great? We use these every day. MySQL is a fundamental part of Google's ad system. So it's important to us that MySQL be healthy. So we try to release tools and software that keep it healthy. And then folks out in the world, yourselves, will often adopt these patches. And they'll make MySQL healthier and better and stronger. And these are all very, very good things, right? So we take sort of this holistic approach. One, we like to do it. We really like releasing code as open source. It's nice, it's fun, it's cool, it's handy. But it's also important to do. So we try to make it a part of everything we do. So we've released over 100 projects to date. I think it was about a year and a half ago, we launched the ability for open source projects to host on code.google.com. After the first year, we had 45,000 projects. Now we're up to 85,000. These are basically open source projects who are developing online on Google's infrastructure. And we're very proud of this. Now, some of them are just place markers. Some of them are backups of their work on other terrific hosting environments like SourceForge and the rest. And that's a great role for us. We're super happy just to be backup for these projects that are so important. So that's really good. I'm very happy about this, by the way. And I know it's important to you that I'm happy, right? and then we have hundreds, literally hundreds of Googlers patching every month into a great variety of projects. Some completely predictable, some a little random. Where was my random example? Yeah, we had a game up here just to see if anyone would notice, you know, for a while, but we actually did have patches into it. But yeah, you know, things like Samba that you use every day, things like the kernel, well, many people use every day. Obviously, things like MySQL. And we actually employ people who either as part of their part-time, or their 20% time, or as part of their full-time job, like Andrew and Jeremy, work on open source software every day, right? And making them better for the outside world. And we determined that their work is so important and so useful that we want to basically just have them work on that full time. Or in the case of Bram, you know, so I talk about Bram because he represents the 20% time. How many of you have not heard of Google 20% time? Wow, that's so cool. It's basically we let engineers take a day off every week to work on something else. And many of them take advantage of it, not enough do, but yeah, anyway. But we made it possible for them to work on outside open source projects as part of that. And people like Bram, this is a great example. It's like, Bram's been working on Vim now for, I think, 22 years. Harold, this is like 22 years. Forever. Functionally, like, my entire professional life, plus many years. Because I'm 36, so if I do the math. Anyway, so I have to tell you, I think sometimes Bram is a little bored with it, right? And he doesn't want to do it full time. But having 20% time at work, he said to me, allows him the flexibility to go ahead and do that work. And he likes it a lot now. He likes it a lot more now than he did before, is kind of the long and short of it. Because it's his break from his regular job, right? It's his fun, which is really pretty cool. So something for the students in the audience that I want to... You said you were 18, right? So you're super old enough for this. Because you have to be 18 or over to take part in this one. We have a 13 to 18 program as well called GHOP. But the Summer of Code is probably one of the things I'm proudest that we do. So this year, most recent year, 2007, we brought on 905 students to work in open source software. As you can see, they worked for open source projects like Samba, like the kernel, like WordPress. I think WordPress was part of last year. They worked with some 1,500 mentors. We had over 6,200 applications that we picked them from. And they were in 90 countries, I think 450 universities, and 81% of them passed. And what that meant, by the way, passing means they got paid the full $4,500. $4,500 used to be worth a lot more, by the way. But it's actually a really terrific experience more than anything else. The money's nice because it keeps people from having to go and get a job flipping burgers. I mean, I like flipping burgers. I like burgers, obviously. Larry Page, Google's co-founder, he said to me, Chris, I want computer scientists programming over the summer. I don't want them doing other things. So go fix that for me. So this was our answer. And then last year, through this program, we figure an additional 2.5 million lines of code almost was written for open source software. So this is something we're super proud of. We're doing it again this year. Where is the thing? Yeah, so we're doing 1,100 students this year. We already picked 175 organizations. And we've got over 5,000 applications. We just closed the application deadline for this. Sorry. And, but yeah, we're trying to get another 3 million lines of code out of this. This is geographic distribution. That's 2006, it's old. It says, wow, people apply. But it's not just computer scientists. We get biologists, we get physicists, we get interior designers, graphic designers. We get all kinds of folks. You know, our only requirement is that they're in college, or university, and we've got a broad idea of what that means. So we've had people who were basically doing one class a semester who we were fine with taking part. But yeah, we've had all kinds of folks take part and find great success through the program. So, and that's not all. You know, we also fund a great variety of external projects, whether it's Music Brains, which is an online service that maintains meta information for music, or Freenet, or Nmap. You know, if you talk to a lot of the major projects, you'll see a little bit of funding here and there from us. And because we want to basically make tools that matter to us better all the time. So, anyway, and here's sort of the why. You know, I think I'm probably butting up against my time. She's like going, yes, shut up. So I think that's it. I don't think we have time for questions, right? We're just going to go on to the next person. But I'll be around today, so find me if you have any questions. And I hope this has been fun for you. So, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Chris, and thanks for interesting introduction to the Google. Thank you. Is there anyone having any questions to Chris right now? No. Okay, you have a question. You'll take it later.
No,
he's cool with the question now. Okay, take it later on. Okay. Da det en stor glede for meg å ønske velkommen til vår kunnskapsminister, Bård Vegar Solhjell. Han har ansvar for huene våre framover. Han skal bygge Norge, og jeg håper også at noe av det handler om fri programvare. Så vær så god, Bård Vegar Solhjell.
Hei. Jeg er vant til at der jeg er nå. Når jeg sier hei, så svarer man hei i kor. Hei. sånn skal det være bra. Jeg kan for så vidt se at dere ser ikke ut som den gjennomsnittlige skoleforsamling når jeg ser dere sånn forfra. Men det hyggelig å være her. Takk for invitasjonen. Og så vil jeg også begynne med å si gratulerer til Friprog-senteret, til Heidi, til ansatte og andre som vil få nytte av det fremover nå. Det en veldig stor glede for meg å kunne være her på åpningskonferansen. Det at vi har valgt å støtte Friprog-senteret,